All right, any questions about our last segment?
You used the expression, and I know I'm supposed to know this, that God is the transcendental meaning of logic. I think you might maybe misunderstand.
God is the transcendental for logic, for science, yeah. The transcendental means the precondition of intelligibility for logic.
Thank you.
That's it?
Yes.
Oh, that was easy. Okay. So now that we know how Michael Martin uses his terms, or at least a few of them we've looked at, let's ask what he is proving in parts one and part two, and then I'd like to look at the way in which he attempts to make his case. Part one is entitled Negative Atheism. Now, how did he define negative atheism? Not believing that God exists. Part two is positive atheism. Positive atheism is believing that God does not exist. Okay, so not believing, believing not. Just because that's sometimes awkward, remember that as synonyms for not believing, I will often say non-belief or unbelief. Non-belief or unbelief. For believing that God does not exist, we'll try to say disbelief. He disbelieves that God exists, rather than simply is non-believing about the existence of God or something. So, if negative atheism is not believing that God exists, and as we've explained what it means not to believe that God exists, namely that there's no justification for believing it, he's not talking about having justification for disbelief. He's saying there is no justification for belief. Everyone with me? I don't believe because there's no justification for it. So negative atheism is the view that belief is not justified. Belief is not justified. And the reason why it's advantageous for Michael Martin to take atheism in that sense, as we've indicated, is that he thinks the burden of proof, it appears he thinks that the burden of proof is slightly shifted, so that now he doesn't have to feel the onus of, you haven't looked at everything, so how can you say there is no God? He can say, well, I've looked at enough things to see that you don't have any good reason to tell me there is a God. So that's what's involved here. Belief is not justified. With the motive that I won't have to now have a burden of proof to show that there cannot be a God, it'd be good enough if I had to show there's no good reason to believe there is a God. And here's the point I want to make by way of criticism. He doesn't avoid what he thinks he's avoiding. Because here's what he's supposed to be proving. Belief is not justified. Okay. So, what he's doing in part one is showing that this proposition here, or this claim, is itself justified. You all with me? That is, he's got to now give some reason for us to believe this. So it turns out that what he's really doing is showing that belief is not justified. Notice I have it in angle brackets. You all understand that convention? That's a claim being made. Not necessarily a quote from anybody, but take this position that belief is not justified. And about that package, he's saying that it is justified. So part one is a long, long, long discussion which attempts to show that belief is not justified is justified. The proposition that there's no justification for believing is itself justified. Turn to page 455. Boy, we've had the gardeners today, and the sirens, and the helicopters. I'm sorry about that. Now here's what Michael Martin tells us in his view. He's done. In chapters 1 to 10, I maintain that belief in an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good being who created the universe is not justified. Of course, if the thesis of chapter 2, that religious language is cognitively meaningless, were to be accepted, this book would be much shorter. He goes on to explain why he didn't leave it at that. And then he says, I argued for not believing in God on independent grounds, and in chapters 11 to 18, I went on to argue for disbelief in God. I argued for not believing in God on independent grounds, apart from the cognitive meaninglessness of religious language. So according to him, he has justified the claim that belief is not justified. And how has he justified it? Turn to page 277. This too is part of putting someone under the microscope. This is what you have to do. It's important that you follow their programmatic statements. What do they think they're doing? What do they say they've accomplished and all that? And it's good to write it out and follow it and say, no, wait a minute, maybe he didn't do what he thought he did, even if he did a good job at what he was doing. Okay, now how is it that he's justified the claim that belief in God is not justified? Page 277. He says in the middle of the first paragraph in the conclusion, although not all theories of faith have been examined here, the ones that were are representative enough to give us confidence that all such arguments will fail.
There he's using inductive principle in his favor.
That's right. That's what we were saying before the break. We were saying he's not playing on a level field, because here he wants to say, I haven't looked at all of it, but I've looked at enough of it to tell you that all of it's no good. Now, what was he trying to avoid, at least on my reconstruction, by redefining the term atheism the way that he did? He was trying to avoid being put in the position where he's got to look at all of the universe and all possible evidence and say there is no God anywhere to be found. He doesn't want to be put in that position. Well, I maintain he's been put back in that position. It's just on a different, you know, angle on the problem. Because he wants to say belief is not justified. Well, he could only say it is not justified. That is, there is no good reason to believe in God if he's examined all the reasons. But now he's admitting he hasn't, and of course he'd have to say he can't examine all the reasons. And so now it turns out that Michael Martin is arguing that belief is not justified, it's justified by failure of some representative viewpoints. It's justified by the failure of some. Representative views. And how is it that they failed? Turn to page 29 and then page 39. Page 29. very bottom of the page. I argue that negative atheism is not justified until it is shown that God talk is cognitively meaningless, or if God talk is cognitively meaningful, that the reasons for believing in God are inadequate. Okay? So, the failure that he's talking about is that the reasons for believing are inadequate. Page 39 as well.
It's kind of adding to the count there by that. If you went down each one of these arguments and showed that reasons for believing in God were adequate, you would just fall back and say what you're saying is meaningless anyway.
Well, he could, and I'm going to argue in a little while that he betrays that he doesn't have confidence in what he showed about the meaninglessness of religious language, because he's written such a long book. If he really has accomplished what he claims to have accomplished, he should have stopped writing. Okay, I think it's entirely hypocritical of him to say, God talk is meaningless, so let me talk to you about it and show that it's inadequate when you reason about it. Now, he feels that, and I didn't count them, but I'll bet you there's at least four different places in the book where he gives his little apologetic for why he's gone on to talk about other things. Because I really do think it's meaningless. But just in case I'm wrong, I'm falling back on it. So this is what I'm putting up here. His fallback is that the reasons for belief are inadequate. Now what if he's wrong about one of the counter arguments against, let's say there's 12 reasons for belief, it's much more better. He considers 12 reasons. He's claiming they're inadequate. Well, now, what if we went back and showed that one of his arguments against one of his refutations of those reasons was itself inadequate? Just in terms of what he says he's going to do or has done, he would fail, wouldn't he?
No, because he said failure of some,
yeah, some
representative, so he still has an out.
No, but what I'm saying is his... He says that he has justified the proposition in question by the failure of some representative views. But if it turns out that the failure of some representative views is overstated because some of them are not inadequate, then he would have lost. I'm just trying to show you that when he sets it up this way, he's not going to have helped himself all that much. Page 39, he says that his argument is not conclusive, but is justified as much as is possible in relation to our present knowledge. Yeah, I think you can see what's coming here, but I'm going to get it up on the board. Let's read. Although the part of my argument that involves undermining the reasons given for belief in theism is by far the most extensive and detailed, it is not conclusive. It might be the case that a new argument will be developed that could support a belief in an all-good, all-powerful, all-knowing being. This possibility seems unlikely, however.
That's where he's almost going up his level playing field for a minute and then backing off.
It shows he's pretty arrogant.
Okay, now I'm going to add something here. The reasons for unbelief are inadequate. Now is qualified as the reasons for belief are not likely to be adequate.
If he really had confidence in his position, he'd say not possible.
Well, he does say that, too. See, what I'm going to try to show here is he's playing both sides of the street. He wants to play the incomplete induction side, and then he also wants to say it is impossible. Because notice what he takes away with one hand, what he's given with the other, just in terms of what I read to you. He says, it's not conclusive. But on the other hand, he says, the possibility that he might be refuted is not likely.
Okay.
So it's not likely that the reasons that are offered are going to be adequate, and therefore they failed.
If we say they're not likely adequate, it's the same, the reasons that haven't been presented yet.
What he says, it's not likely that an adequate reason will be given. I've had to abbreviate it because I don't want to mark on the wall over here.
Because it's not likely.
What he says is not likely is that an adequate reason will be given.
But he doesn't know in advance that they're about these future arguments. He has no basis for passing judgment on these future arguments, right?
Yeah, well, all of you should circle the word unlikely. As I put in my margin, how does Michael Martin know what is likely? I mean, I'm only talking about the claims he's making for his own claims. I'm not trying to pin anything on him or, you know, be pushy. I'm just saying, what are you saying, Michael? And then when you say, here's what it comes down to. Here's why I don't believe in God. I don't think it's likely you'll ever have a good reason to. Okay. But how do you know that, Michael? How do you know what is likely or not likely?
Not use the same terms and say, well, you think it's unlikely that you'll ever find a natural reason for the resurrection.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Now, he says in the last paragraph, although a conclusive case cannot be made for negative atheism, if a good case can be made for supposing that belief in God should be based on reason and that all the available reasons for believing in an all-good, all-powerful, all-knowing being are inadequate, negative atheism in the narrow sense will be justified as much as it can be in relation to our present knowledge. So now it's justified by not likely, and now the not likely is qualified by what? In terms of our present knowledge.
Unconclusive.
Yike. We have a justification that is not conclusive. I'm just trying to put it all together again. I haven't argued against the guy yet. I just want him to, you know, be drawn out as to what he's actually claiming. He says, if we have good grounds for supposing that all available reasons for believing in an all-good, all-powerful, and all-knowing being are inadequate when such reasons are needed for justified belief, then people would be justified in having no belief that such a being exists. I'm just repeating what you already know. He's talking about justifying their belief, that belief is not justified by, it turns out, an unconclusive failure of some representative views because they fail in that the reasons for belief are not likely to be given which are adequate in terms of our present knowledge. I hope you all feel this, but you know what? The tiger has just been tamed. Because I could stand back and say, oh, that's what you're trying to prove? Now, I don't think you do even that. But if you prove that, I still don't have any reason not to believe in God. Why? Well, because it's so highly qualified.
Yeah,
I'm saying, well, have you shown that I shouldn't believe in God? He says, yes, I have. Conclusively? Well, no. Have you shown that I should never believe in God? Oh, no, just in terms of our present knowledge. Have you shown that all the arguments are inadequate? No, just some of them. So some of the arguments, I unconclusively can say that some of the arguments at the present time leave us believing that there never will be an argument that's adequate. I mean, actually, it just doesn't hold together. What he's attempting to do doesn't leave anybody in a position of being embarrassed for believing in God. Now, he could always say, well, what's your adequate reason? Now, I happen to think that we have some, but in terms of what he thinks he's proven, a person can say, I don't know. Sometimes we know things are true and we're still working on the best way of putting it together. I know that God exists and I think there's going to be a good reason that someone will formulate. And he's going to have to say what to that? He's going to have to say, oh, well then you're living by faith. And you're going to say back, and you are living by faith. Faith that there will never be such an argument in terms of our present knowledge and your unconclusive evaluation of an inadequate induction of the arguments, you're saying there never will be. So that takes a lot of faith. So that what we have in the case of the debate between a Christian and Michael Martin is conflicting faith claims. That's on the best interpretation. I happen to think it's not going to turn out so well for him as even that. But all he's doing here is saying, I have my faith that there will be no good arguments developed, and I have my faith based on what? An incomplete induction, non-conclusive considerations, and the hope that the future is going to be like this. He has the faith that no adequate reasons, all to say, will come, pardon my grammar, will be provided and so forth. And this faith that no adequate reasons will come is based on a non-conclusive survey of some reasons in terms of our present knowledge. Now let me finish this. I'm writing this out for you because I want to say it's not just that he's got a faith claim here, but notice the kind of faith he's talking about. His faith is that he can talk about what will come in terms of what is present, and not even all the stuff that is present, but only some of the stuff that's present, and only a non-conclusive consideration of some of the stuff that's present. Okay, I'm sorry, Bill.
No, that was it. I want to know how induction fit in there. You just explained that.
Oh, exactly.
Very good.
It all comes down to not just a faith claim, but a faith particularly in induction, that the future will be like the past in that if we've never seen a good argument, we never will see a good argument. Now, let's see what kind of things we could substitute into this argument form. This is always the fun part of being a philosopher. Once you see the structure of the argument, take out the key terms and put a few other ones in there and say, is this the way we reason on other matters? But before I do that, you have a question.
Isn't that the problem of induction, though? And doesn't every inductive argument fail at that point? At a similar point? That we don't have all the...
If it's a negative inductive argument, they all fail at that point, yeah. Okay. Not all positive inductive arguments fail. For instance, I could give you a positive inductive argument that quinine relieves the symptoms of malaria, and it would be justified tomorrow to apply quinine to a malaria sufferer. But if I say, up to this point, something has not happened, therefore it will not happen, we've really turned the tables logically on that. Okay? In other words, it's almost like an extended argument from silence. Since there hasn't been anything in the past like this, there will never be anything in the future like this. So I'll give you an example. We have faith that this is an argument given in 1776. We have faith that no automobile will ever be devised. Well, somebody might say, well, that's not a very good thing for you to have faith, and who knows what's going to happen? So, oh, no, it's justified. You say, well, how's it justified? Well, because I've looked at some possible locomotive type things, and although I haven't conclusively refuted them, the sum I've looked at, in terms of our present knowledge, give me no reason to think it will ever happen. You all with me?
A lot of people said that about going to the moon.
Oh, people have said this about all sorts of things. Now, what I want to know is, let me give my own inductive argument now, since Mr. Martin is so enamored of them. Since in most cases in the past, when people have arrogantly said present knowledge is enough to say it's impossible we'll ever know or develop something like X in the future, in most cases that's proved to be an embarrassment. My conclusion is most likely you're going to be embarrassed with this argument for negative atheism. Do you think he would like that? I know he wouldn't, but he's given me all of the tools I need to do it. And the reason I keep writing it out is I just want you to see how he has set this up himself. I haven't come and said, you got to accept this, and now I've got you in trouble. He ties himself in this knot. This is a terrible argument.
Doesn't the existence of his own book refute that argument? Because he went back and studied philosophy, right, and people that were gone through and done a detailed study of why you shouldn't believe in God, mm-hmm, and since there is now an argument, that means an argument which he says will never come to pass, could come to pass, because this one hasn't existed yet.
Actually, what he says in the book, you may recall, is that in one sense this book is not needed because people have done it all. However, they have not taken up the most sophisticated philosophical philosophy of religion arguments in the last 20 years. And so he's supplementing that. But your point's still a well-taken one. Couldn't somebody 20 years ago have said, we don't have anything else we have to worry about, it's not going to be developed? Now, all he would say is, yes, and it hasn't been developed, as my book shows. And since it hasn't been developed up to then, and it hasn't been developed since then, I now inductively generalize it will not be developed ever.
Okay.
It all depends on what you think is likely to happen in history, huh? And if it comes down to what you think is likely to happen in the future, then this is a faith commitment. It all depends upon things which are not experienced, or things which you can know conclusively. So he has his faith that there'll never be a good reason for believing in God, and I have my faith that there will be. Of course, I have more than that. I have faith that there is a good reason to believe in God. But his argument's just not going to wash. I have a couple other things I wanted to put in here. Page 210. I think it's just rehearsing what we've already chopped up pretty thoroughly. But oh, this is another. It's a subordinate example. It's not the whole section. But notice what he says here at the end of the introductory paragraph. He goes, it is impossible, of course, to survey all the minor arguments ever given that God exists. However, I will examine what are considered by scholars to be the most important of these.
First of all,
well, you better know that I'm going to jump in with 2 feet. Because he says the most important arguments are going to be considered. And I've already pointed out, at least what I think is the most important argument doesn't get dealt with in the book at all. Now, what is he going to do when I point that out? And I don't say this with any false humility. He's going to say, you're not an important scholar. That's all right.
Or he'll categorize
Believe me.
With someone who he has dealt with not understanding the sentence.
That's right. The problem is that this sentence will only prove to be true if he's allowed to do the selection of who the important scholars are. And it's not that my pride is wounded that he won't count me as one of the important scholars. I just want to point out that the procedure begs the question. That you can only make this claim good if you decide in advance you know the truth. And people who don't follow the truth as you see it don't count as important scholars. Now, he would probably say that's not altogether fair because I've looked at a lot of important scholars here who don't agree with me. Alvin Plantinga, Norman Malcolm, people like that. You see, I didn't say that he wouldn't look at important scholars. His claim is He doesn't have to survey all the minor arguments. He says, I will examine what are considered by scholars to be the most important of these arguments. And so Alvin Plantinga may very well be an important scholar, Norman Malcolm, add him up. But that doesn't mean that he's still that he has looked at the most important arguments.
So
unless he thinks most important arguments are defined by what these scholars that I choose tell me. In which case, we're back to the reasoning in a circle. Go ahead.
So it comes down to a matter of authority.
That's right.
Ultimately.
Yeah, and authority based on what you know to
what
be true.
You know, you're right.
So as long as what he knows, excuse me, as long as what he claims is something that he knows, that God doesn't exist, then his selection of scholars may make sense. But if he chooses scholars who don't ever give the transcendental argument in the way that I've given, I have reason to say, no, you haven't looked at all the arguments, or even the representative ones, or even the most important ones. Well, I'm just trying now to whittle down his claims for you. One last whittling. If you look at page Roman numeral 12.
I'm going to say something on his behalf. Why, it seems to me, if I was much more than to say, well, I mean, historically important as far as what most people have talked about in recognized journals, would have had an impact on culture. And in that sense...
And in that sense, it's an outright lie. Because you know that he was so thorough in looking at things here that he picked up stuff that you and I both know from our reading of philosophy of religion no one thinks is important. So forget this, I've picked the most important arguments. Won't work. The nose count just won't wash. I'm sorry, Mike, I didn't mean to interrupt you in your defending of this guy. Go ahead.
He'd say, well, yeah, I throw something in there just for gravy on top of it. Some real, you know, I don't consider it important at all, but I just throw it anyway.
It's just all pretty arbitrary, though. He's a scholar who consider other arguments to be more important.
Well, yes.
Or another way, I think we
claim is, okay, I'm going to cover all the important stuff. Doesn't mean everything in this book that are important is important. I can some unimportant things.
Maybe puts
okay, so a faster way to cut through all of this stuff is just to say, do you consider it an important claim, Mr. Martin, that you wouldn't be able to justify your reasoning at all in light of the worldview of atheism? I mean, he would have to say, yes, that's an important claim. He may say it's idiotic, no way you can prove it, but that's certainly an important claim. And so since he hasn't considered it, he hasn't considered the representative most important claim.
The fact that he hasn't proves a Christian worldview.
That he hasn't?
That he hasn't considered the most important claim because he couldn't have wrote the book.
Well, I'm not sure what you're getting at, if there's something subtle here or I'm missing it. I would say what it proves is he has his biases.
Anything in that's existence all proves fits in the Christian worldview.
Yeah.
Like you said, Van Til said we could start wherever we want. We could start with the book.
Yes.
And one of the arguments could be, since you didn't deal with the issue, it proves our worldview in Romans 1 that you're suppressing the truth.
Okay, we could say, here's just one more inductive piece of evidence that what the Bible says is true. You've suppressed the most important argument because you won't even look at the one that's most hostile to your position.
Okay,
I follow you.
Of course he won't like
that. Let me say just one more thing. I'm just getting unimportant. I think it's obviously an important claim that Van Til makes and you make. But he could say, well, look, there could be an important novel out there. Somebody can say, well, this is a really important novel. Nobody's ever read it. It's not in part of the canon of literature like Tolstoy or something. And so somebody says, well, this piece I know he's heard of is an important book. A literature professor would have to be right in one sense to say, it's not an important book. Nobody's read it. And so one sense he's right. Another sense it could be a gem of a book and be important because it's a gem.
No, I would say in terms of the kind of illustration you're giving, that if it were what you were saying it is, it would be in the canon of Western literature. And the fact that it's not in the canon of Western literature. But you see, we don't have a canon of the arguments that people think are great. In fact, that he puts the gravy ones in here, as you say, shows that he's not following the canon anyway, even if it did exist. Well, I don't want to make more of this than I have to. I've just tried to whittle down what he is claiming. And the last piece of whittling is on Roman numeral 12, three quarters of the way down. He says, although I have not changed my opinion that disbelief in God is more justified than belief, as I explained in the introduction. Recent philosophical arguments for theism make it necessary to reassess and reformulate the case for atheism. I just want you to catch that expression. Notice that now it is a relative matter. Okay? It's a matter of more justified. Oh, I took my initial sentence off the board already, but you saw how I was going through qualifying. It's justified by inconclusive knowledge at this time, some cases, blah, blah, blah. You can add there that it's not justified, but more justified than the opposite, so forth. So, are we dealing with a guy who's making bold claims? Yeah. But we're also dealing with a person who, at crucial points in his program, qualifies those claims. If you're familiar with the religious language debate, you know how Anthony Flew made such effective rhetorical use of this idea of dying the death of a thousand qualifications. Here's the guy who believes in the invisible gardener. With what was a fine, brash hypothesis has died by inches. Okay, I haven't done as well as Flew on that particular story, but I'm in that same ballpark when I say what started out as a fine, brash hypothesis has really begun to die by inches, hasn't it? Qualify, 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 qualify. And in the end, he hasn't accomplished what he thinks he has, even if his arguments are good ones, because all he's saying is, well, at this time, I have faith that there's no good reason to believe in God, never will be.
Yeah, isn't he saying that to justify something isn't necessarily to be conclusive?
What yeah, he does believe in inductive generalization. He doesn't think that not being conclusive is all that damaging. But inductive generalization assumes a lot about the representative and important nature of the cases you've looked at. And I've just challenged that. I said, why didn't you deal with the toughest cases of all?
No, okay. Go ahead. I was going to ask. His main assertion is that faith that is not adequate, faith that no adequate reasons will come. He's saying will come in the future, right?
That's right.
Well, if he's an atheist, he can't say anything about the future because he can't assume that the future is going to be like the past.
That's
so
right.
His whole book assumes
a Christian worldview. So that he can make his claim that if I've proven what I think I've proven, it'll stand for the rest of the future. Okay, so what's he think he's proven? That the Christian worldview is inadequate. So let's see if we can put it all together. It comes down to saying, if the Christian worldview is true, so that induction can be counted on, then the Christian worldview, there'll never be any good reason to think that it's true. That's the form of all presuppositional reductio ad absurdum. It's like, oh, what you're getting at is, if you can take part of the Christian worldview, then you can say the whole worldview is wrong. I can use this ladder to climb up, and when I get to the roof, I can kick the ladder away and declare myself, you know, a champion. But of course, you need a Christianity. He's running all these arguments on the back, you know, of the Christian worldview. So that he can turn around and reject the Christian worldview. Good observation, Bill.
Think about it. Just to back off and get a 50,000-foot view of this thing, I was criticized 20 years ago, I remember, for having inductive arguments about God. And someone, Vantillion, said to me, you're dishonoring God because you're just making him seem like a probable God to our non-Christian friend.
Right.
Well, here, and so that's what the foundationalist, the evidentialist is accused of. Now, isn't he kind of doing the non-Christians, isn't he using the same machinery to say, well, very probably the Christian God doesn't exist? Isn't it, he starts with the bold claim, but after he qualifies it, isn't he down to an inductive argument then? Is that what you've been saying?
Okay. Yeah, I thought we had said that a couple of times, but yeah, by summary, that is exactly it. But he doesn't think that's a defect. He thinks inductive arguments are all we do have, and that's perfectly all right. But then you see he shouldn't be so brash in his hypothesis if he ends up saying, but what I mean by this is that I think in the future we'll never have any good arguments. Somebody can say, well, how do you know we haven't in the past? He goes, well, I really don't, but it's not conclusive. But the ones I've looked at don't look very good. So it's not even a strong induction.
Okay, I see.
It's only an induction based on what he thinks are the representative important arguments.
That's a qualified inductive argument.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very qualified. Okay, let's look at how Michael Martin now tries to make his case. We're not going to get into the detailed arguments, but again, I'm going to look at his program for arguing his case. And the first thing I want to point out is his overreaching dogmatism. We've just shown how humble his thesis really turns out to be. Give you a few illustrations of this dogmatism. Page 194. This is the one sentence refutation of the transcendental argument. You can tell me if you're really impressed with this. It's about a third of the way down the page. It's in the paragraph spanning what is number 5 and then before he gets to 1 prime. And he says, "There is no reason why naturalists cannot use terms such as truth, validity, and probability to explicate rational thinking. Indeed, this is precisely what recent naturalists have done." Well, this is the approach he's going to take when he debates me. It won't be a very long debate, will it? Because all I have to, I'm going to point out that on your worldview, probability and validity are meaningless. You cannot make intelligible use of the concept of logical validity or of scientific probability on your worldview because you're a naturalist. And he's going to answer, there's no reason why naturalists cannot use terms like these. Indeed, that's precisely what recent naturalists have done. I put down on my margin, I said, no, have attempted. Now, isn't that overreaching dogmatism to announce to the audience, we've done it? Well, I think it's, especially in a big book that's supposed to be so thorough, we might have been treated to know how they did it. And I want to suggest this is not so much malice on his part, where he's saying, I'm just going to claim that it's done and kind of avoid it. I think he takes it so much for granted, he's not even critical of his own presuppositions. And so he can say, well, naturalists have tried to explicate validity. I know that very well. I've read them. And they're all miserable arguments. And it's not just Christians who say that. Non-Christians will say, this is embarrassing. How do you explicate validity in terms of induction? You can't. Well, I won't say you can't. No one has done it. But he says they have. Now the reader's supposed to believe him on his say-so?
See, that's why I had a problem when he talked about in the other section on the meaninglessness of religious language.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't justify his use of terms in any sense at all.
No, he doesn't.
Justify, you know, any type of truth or knowledge or absolute values.
Yeah, we're jumping ahead here to something I hope I'll get in before our 4 o'clock cutoff. But you'll find out that not only does he not justify it in terms of a general theory of language, he says he has no general theory of language in terms of which to justify it, but he just assumes it can be worked out. Well, if we continue our qualification, I want you to follow this, you know, down the line. Hold on to this guy. What he's going to say is that he doesn't even have a theory in terms of which he can make the judgments he's making. He doesn't have a general theory in which he can say Christians are wrong to think or to speak in this way. He doesn't have a general theory, but he believes it could be worked out. So now his argument is, I have faith that we could work out a theory in terms of which we could argue against you. Well, I think we could all pack it in and say, great, come back when you got it. No, in the meantime, we're going to continue believing in God and rationality and all the rest. But back to what I was giving on page 194, this is appalling to me because it comes the closest to his dealing with a transcendental form of argument. And he dismisses it in one sentence, or two if you want to count his claim, it's been done, which is not at all true. He should have said it has been attempted. And I put down in the margin, just so you'll see why this claim doesn't stand, when he says there's no reason why naturalists couldn't use validity, well, there's nothing in the natural experience of men, nothing in their empirical natural experience that has the qualities which characterize validity. Okay? What is validity characterized by? Universality, first of all. Whatever is a valid argument is universally valid in that form. But nothing in my... Have you ever experienced anything that's universal? Well, we can buy a universal joint at the auto parts store, but you know what I mean by universal. Have you ever experienced any particular thing that was universal? I mean, Mike, help me here. Is he just being dense? No, I just don't... Oh, you think he is? You think that he realizes there's a problem and he's just...
Oh, no. Yeah, I think he's being dense, sort of not realizing the problem.
Yeah, that's right. I think he's just over his... Not over his head intellectually. He's a smart guy. But I think it just escapes him altogether, what he's claiming. He says, there's no reason why naturalists cannot use terms like this. I'll say, well, prima facie, let's say I'm just, you know, some dumb Sunday school kid who believes in God and so forth, but... You know, I can point to the king and say he has no clothes, even though I'm nothing but a child. Prima facie, isn't it true that what is natural is not universal, and that's what you mean by valid? Oh, there's no problem in saying that circles are square.
We've done it.
Yeah, in fact, I just said it. And we can justify it, too. And you say, well, how could you possibly justify it? Well, it's been done. Go read the articles. It's been done. No, I think at just that point, what he's supposed to do is show us how it can be done. And he hasn't shown us at all. I take this as an example of overreaching dogmatism. And then there's another one, well, there's more than what I'm going to give you, but I've got some juicy ones.
At that point, having just made an assertion like that, why would he not think he needs to demonstrate it when he goes through and demonstrates so many, or tries to demonstrate so many assertions that he makes?
Yeah, I thought of this, well, if we're saying the same thing, why doesn't he just dismiss the whole case in the same way? I mean, why does he go through, you know, almost tediously many of these arguments and so forth? Why doesn't he just write a one-paragraph refutation of theism by saying, theism can be disproven, we've done it. Or to say, there's no reason to believe in the Christian God. We've shown it. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to put this much work into a book that's supposed to cover the ground and then just to dismiss it here and say, well, there's no problem here. No, and as you know, I can't expect him to anticipate the way we feel or the way I feel. But from what I feel, that is the most important thing he should be doing, is explaining to me how naturalism can make sense of arguments. You know, if it can do that, then we can go on to argue about whatever you want to argue, but I'm not sure that naturalism can even get up off the floor to argue with anybody. And we've been using validity. The same thing could be said about probability. How can naturalism justify any claim about probability? If naturalism is taken in its customary sense, there's no personal God that's guiding things. Now, there are people who personify nature. I want to warn you here. Okay, so people might say, well, that's the way nature does things. You hear that expression even from atheistic scientists. They will talk as though there's a Mother Nature out there, like Father God, doing things. But if we, you know, stop them in their tracks and say, now you can't get away with that way of talking, I want to know, if there's nothing but the natural world, how could you tell me what tomorrow's going to be like? The natural world doesn't determine that tomorrow's going to be like that. You don't believe in, you know, some kind of causal nexus here. That's, you know, that's been dismissed with David Hume, right? So what I'm getting at here is he has a sentence where he deals with two crucial things, validity and probability. And he says there's no reason why naturalists couldn't explain those terms. Okay. A faith commitment, but it's worse than a faith commitment. As you can see my style here, I like to lay it on in layers here. It's not just that he has a faith commitment there won't be any good reasons down the line. He has a faith commitment that the reasons he's now given don't have to be argued either. There's no reason why we have to explain this. And his faith commitment is based on his dogmatism. He can say it on his own say-so.
In the introduction on page 25, 26,
go ahead.
This was the most telling at the very last paragraph, about 25. He says, although I argue that atheistic belief is rational and justified, theism is not. No extended theory of rationality or justification is given. And then he says that the reason why he's not going to do it, at least for him, he says, given the controversial state of general epistemological theories. So I didn't know if he had one but just didn't want to give it, or he's really saying, the fact of the matter is I have mine, but there are many others. So he's not even as assured as he sounds here and on page 194. He's less assured he seems here.
The reason I'm smiling, Alfred, and I don't mind you doing this because we're in seminar style, that was the punchline of today's class. That was what I was finally working to, and I'm glad you've anticipated it. I wanted to work you down to the point where it turns out he uses all these terms in view of an unworked out theory of epistemology. And so in the end, what he is telling, I just want you to see what he's claiming. In the end, all he's saying is, in terms of an unworked out theory of epistemology, which would be very controversial if we tried, and an inconclusive look at some of the arguments, how could you talk about what's probable or not probable, what's valid or not? He doesn't have a general theory in terms of which he can make any of these claims stick. And so I thank you very much for bringing that up, because that is exactly where I was going. I was going to work my way right back to the point where, and by the way, what is his theory? Well, let me tell you what I was going to do. Here's a list of words that you will find over and over and over again in this man's argumentation. I'm not suggesting you should never use such words, but I don't think there should ever be a freestanding argument. Okay, like if I think I've shown that rationality requires the Christian God, I can say, certainly if you want to be a rational man, you're going to have to believe in God. Because I've got an argument where I'm trying to show the certainty of that. But what bothers me is that over and over and over again in his arguments, he gets to a crucial premise and he goes, well, it's obvious then. By the way, I'm bothered by that even when I'm inclined to agree with him as to what's obvious. The point is, in a book like this, you shouldn't have freestanding premises that are only introduced with this kind of adverbial, everyone knows that, obviously that, it's plausible that, and so forth. So just, I did this at random to begin with, and I wish now when I went through the second time, I had known I was going to do this, but the second time through, it finally just got under my skin. So I started just making a list of the expressions he used, and to be honest, I boxed it out on my little flow chart, and I didn't leave myself enough room. This guy does it over and over and over again. Now, his view, he needs a general view of what makes something meaningful. He needs a general view of what it means to interpret a sentence without contradiction. Those are major issues. But he will talk about, in passing, what is meaningful, or what is, you know, obviously, he says this can't be interpreted in a non-contradictory way at one point about something in the Bible. Well, maybe it can't. I mean, for argument's sake, I'll grant that. But, you know, he can't show that it cannot be interpreted in a non-contradictory way unless he has a general theory of meaning and a general theory of how language works. Now, I think he does have a rough and ready one, but he doesn't want to argue it. He doesn't want to lay it out for us. Now, I have one too. And you know what? In terms of mine, which I will lay out, and I have done, I've got a class on hermeneutics, I have a way of arguing, you can't show me a contradiction in the Bible. That is, every case you give me, I can, in terms of legitimate hermeneutical principles, show there's no necessity to interpret that as a contradiction. You know the example that we hear often in apologetics. So people say, well, it's a contradiction in the resurrection accounts, because one says that there was an angel and another says there were two angels. That's a contradiction. Well, on my theory of language, and also I think it's rather commonsensical too, but anyway, on my worked out theory of language, there is an interpretation that you can legitimately give to those two sentences where there's no logical conflict at all. Because if there was two angels, there was also one. And I say that's also common sense. I made it sound like it was big-time philosophy. But the point is, my theory of language also matches what everybody knows, that there's no conflict there. However, on my theory of language, there would be a contradiction if it said there were two angels, and another sentence says there was only one angel. So if only were in those sentences, then on my theory of language, I'd have a pretty tough time with the Bible. Now, that's an easy illustration. My conviction is, as a Christian, that all of them can be explained one way or another. Now, his conviction is all of them cannot be. But isn't he incumbent, if they cannot be, to disprove my theory of language or offer an alternative in terms of which he can make them contradictory? He doesn't ever do that. He talks about what is meaningful, what is interpretable without contradiction, and he has no general theory in terms of which to do it. But now let me give you a list of words and phrases that he'll have here. He talks about what reason shows. I'm going to get a few of these on the board. I'm not going to write them all. Okay, in the process of showing us non-conclusively that some of the arguments that he looks at justify that there will be no arguments. Remember, we've attenuated this thing almost out to the point where it's going to tear apart of its own. It's so tissue thin. But once you get his claim all the way attenuated, I want you to note that he often makes his points, which he thinks have supported that, by finally appealing to what he calls reason. Reason tells us that. He appeals to what is reasonable over and over. He says it's not reasonable this or it is reasonable that. He tells us what is plausible. He talks about, over and over again, surely this and surely that. He talks about rational belief. This is a rational belief. That's not a rational belief. He talks about what is normal. This is a real good one. What is normal? I think you can all see where I'm going just with that word. Normal itself presupposes what? A general framework in terms of which you have norms. I'd like to know the general framework in terms of which that's normal and that's abnormal. He talks about what is absurd. He talks about rational belief. He talks about what is irrational. Over and over again. It would be irrational to think that. He talks about good reason. We have good reason, he says. Don't you love it when he does that? I always want to say, give it to me. That's like somebody saying, I've got ice cream. So I want some. Give me it. You've got good reason? I want that good reason. And instead he just plays around. He's just teasing us. We've got good reason to believe. But maybe it's not so good. Do we look at it to see if it really is so good? Now he doesn't give it to us. He talks about what is a simpler explanation. What kind of surprises me and those of you who've read Wittgenstein is, how could he have read Wittgenstein and then do that? Wittgenstein just devastates this notion that simple and complex, we all know how to use those words. No, we don't. What is simple on one hypothesis or in one framework is complex on the other and vice versa. So what you take to be simple is what? is based on your conceptual framework. What you take to be normal is, what did I say? Based on your conceptual framework. What you take to be irrational is based on your conceptual framework. Well, there's more. Oh, likely. He tells us what is likely, what is more likely, what is not likely. He says, not very likely that. I always want to know why. Why isn't it likely? These are big ones. Possible and probable. Over and over again, he tells us what is possible. He tells us what is probable. And he usually tells us what is probable without any kind of calculus for probability theory, which is what he's supposed to, you know something about. And maybe he spared us because we'd all have a tough time understanding it. But it is interesting that he just dogmatically tells us, this is not probable, this is more probable, this is probable. Conceivable, that's an important one. What is conceivable, he appeals to. And then also what is not conceivable. Sometimes he tells us that certain lines of argument strongly suggest. He also, we've already attacked this one, but he'll use the term scholarship, or scholars know, or scholars strongly suggest. And then he talks about what has good sense.
On the back of the book, Gordon Stein says that his scholarship is impeccable.
His scholarship is. Yeah, okay. And we have it on the say-so of another atheist, that his scholarship is impeccable. Now, it's possible that this atheist, whose scholarship is impeccable, when he appeals to other scholars, is doing the same thing Stein is, right? He's saying, in my opinion, you can count on this. Back it down, he says, what seems to be, he uses seems and so forth. I lost my place in my list. I think I've got most of them anyway.
Well, he uses also convincing and dubious. He says, well, that's dubious.
Yes, dubious, convincing, and I also see seriously accepted arguments. They'll talk about what's seriously accepted. You know, like I know people who seriously accept this. I know a few people who are real, you know, they're not very serious about it. What is this? Seriously accepted means by people who are good scholars. They accept that. We have a highly attenuated thesis. He says, in light of an inconclusive look at some representative important arguments, and in terms of our present knowledge, we can say that it's not justified, or that it is justified to say that belief in God is not justified. And that, it turns out, I don't have a big enough board to put all of it, you know. Okay, so now that rests upon things which, when you whittle them down, will come down, I can't say in every case, but you have enough terms up here, you can say, this is amazing. If he uses every one that's on the board 10 times, you've got a pretty full book. Arguments that come down to what is absurd, what is rational, what is likely, what is probable, what is possible, conceivable, on and on and on, coming down to that. Does this automatically mean that he's wrong? No. I'm just trying to show you the character of the thesis. If the thesis comes down to this, now what we're going to call for, in the case of every one of them, if we wanted to be real picky, but let's be generous. In the case of many of these terms, what you need is a general theory that tells you when things are absurd or irrational, when they are likely, when they are reasonable. You need some general theory of justification, of belief, so you can tell us what a good reason is, or what a plausible reason is, or what is a, your conceptual scheme will tell you what is simple, what is complex, all that. So you have rash hypothesis, now attenuated down to this, well, in terms of arguments that we've looked at, in terms of present knowledge, all of which rest upon, not all, but a good number, come down to arguments resting on this. And so now we have the right to say, well, then tell us your general epistemology. What is your theory of knowledge? in terms of what you claim, it's irrational for us to believe the following, and that's why we have no good reason. Go ahead.
One of the things I noticed, too, is he seems to feel that he has his own right to determine what is all good and what an all good God would consider.
Yeah, I put that in a different section of my notes here, but you're absolutely right. He has his preconceptions that he never critically examines. So he can tell us what a good God would end up doing. Well, how does he know that? You know? He has all sorts of things like that. So let me give you some illustrations of it if I can before the day is out. I'm not done, though, with this line of criticism. I want to get to what Alfred brought up.
By using all these terms as repetitiously as he is, then he uses the terms which are favorable to him in terms of the people he likes, people who doesn't like, then he uses negative terms.
Right.
So to prove his thesis, he's assuming.
That's what I'm trying to show. That, in essence, what he is saying is, if you assume an atheist outlook, atheism is proven. Negative atheism. Now attenuated down to, remember, in terms of present knowledge, in a non-conclusive way, looking at some of the arguments which I think are representative and important. That's bad enough. I mean, I think I would have egg all over my face in graduate school if I'd written a paper and a professor came back and said, look what you've done here. You're not even making any important claims here. And then on top of it, he went on to say, and what you are claiming is based on some concept of rationality, probability, validity, and so forth. And I have no idea what your view of that is. And here's what... Luke, over here. Alfred's already given you the key text. I have a couple more to look at. Let's look at pages 25 and 26. So Michael Martin's standing there saying, yes, well, I don't think your arguments are very plausible. I'll just use plausible here. Okay, and then what is your general theory of knowledge in terms of which plausibility is evaluated? Page 25, last paragraph. This book has limitations not only from an atheistic point of view, but from a general philosophical one as well. Although I argue that atheistic belief is rational and justified, and that theism is not, notice the although. He knows what he's doing here. He says, although I'm making these claims, no extended theory of rationality or justification is given. No doubt the few general comments I do make about these topics are controversial. Okay, I'm trying to show you how you build this tower of what stands on what. Now you have to add that what little he does give, he admits is controversial. So now let's put the whole thesis together. In terms of no general theory of knowledge and controversial comments that I've made in passing, I believe it's implausible to think that any good reason, in light of our present knowledge, will ever be given. What I find interesting is that if we could work this all out for him, I'm not sure he's ever put it all together himself, but if we could put all these qualifications and ellipses together for him and say, okay, this is what you're saying, basically, I don't think anybody, even an undergraduate who hated God, would be all that interested to listen to him. They say, oh, well, I need stronger stuff than this. Am I right? How can he rule out something as irrational, implausible, not likely, doesn't seem, so forth, if he doesn't have any way of telling us, well, what makes something likely, what makes something unlikely? He goes, I don't have any general theory. Well, what makes something reasonable or more reasonable? I don't have any general theory to answer that. Well, but you do draw a distinction between what you think is reasonable and what is unreasonable. Oh, yeah. I say, well, but how did you draw that? Oh, I only have controversial comments in passing about that. I have controversial comments in passing about what might have been a general theory in terms of which I could make sense out of these distinctions. Page 26. Where the line begins in 25. Indeed, it seems to me that any attempt to justify them by subsuming them under a larger theory would be premature given the controversial state of general epistemological theories. Ay, ay, ay. Earlier we saw that he said, in light of present knowledge. And we saw that was a way of kind of backing off. He's saying, only in terms of our present knowledge could we say this. And now what is the state of our present knowledge? Controversial. When it comes to what we know about knowledge, he says, in general, epistemology, and by the way, on this he's very good in describing, epistemology is in shambles today. You have people trying to work out theories of reference and meaning and justification and, you know, are you a foundationalist, are you a pragmatist, and so forth. I mean, it's just wild out there. Now, I find it, God's just given me an interest in that sort of thing, so I mean, I kind of enjoy going through that. But if anybody were to say, isn't the house of philosophy in good order, you'd say, no, not at all. We can't decide who belongs here and who doesn't. We don't know what the rules of the game are anymore. Philosophy is just up for grabs. So he's right. There, general epistemological theories are very controversial today.
He says foundationalism on page 20. He's not talking about epistemological foundationalism, is he?
No, he is.
Oh, he is?
Yeah. Good.
He knows he's picking and choosing. It's like whatever the pony wants to hit it. When you want to plant it, he also turns to Lawrence Bonjour and takes a coherence.
That's right.
View of truth.
Yeah.
And justification. At that point, at other times, he's taking the...
Now, let's take that. I hadn't thought about that, but let's take that as a specimen here. Is it wrong for us to depend on a scholar sometimes and disagree with him other times? Not if you what? If you have a rationale or principle in terms of which you can say he's reliable here, he's not reliable there. But let's say you have no idea of how to sort it out and it's all controversial. Then if you make use of a scholar sometimes or disagree with him other times, what you're showing is you just have a prejudice. And anytime somebody will rubber stamp your prejudice, you'll say, oh, that's a good argument. But if they go against your prejudice, oh, that's not very plausible. I mean, this is the sort of thing which when you go to college, and especially when you become a philosophy major, this is what we're supposed to teach students not to do. We're supposed to teach them to be consistent, to have underlying principles, to be able to explicate them and justify them. What he's saying here is, I can't tell you what my principles are. Even if I could, they would be controversial. But in terms of them, I'm going to apply my analysis to this as rational, that irrational, and so forth. This is terrible. This book is absolutely terrible. If I'd started this morning, you would have thought I was in a bad mood. But I'm just telling you, from a scholarly standpoint, this stinks. I'm going to give you another sentence here on page 26 that is interesting. He goes on to say, it is far better in my view to develop certain middle-level principles of justification that are in accord with our ordinary and scientific rational practice and to argue for atheism in terms of these. Layer upon layer. Okay, he says he doesn't want to, well, it's not just that he doesn't want, he can't offer, doesn't want to offer, in light of the controversy, a general epistemological theory. He says, I think it's better if we try for middle principles. Okay.
What are middle principles?
Well, he's not going to line out a complete theory. What he's going to say is, though, there are things which we're going to want involved in any theory, which though they are not the ultimate principles, every theory would have to...
The common denominator.
Well, they are common. That's why they're general. But they're not ultimate. They're only middle-level justification principles. Okay. I can show you, just in terms of the relativity of middle-level. If someone says, I'm going to argue that bread that's left out for 5 days becomes moldy, and I'm going to be able to justify that if you will grant as a middle principle that nature is uniform. The person could say, now I can't prove to you that nature is uniform, so it's only a middle level. I have more work to do. So here he's saying he thinks it's better. Can you believe this? It's better if we have middle level principles. Wouldn't most people? I mean, I'm going to play his game now. Don't most people speak in such a way that it would be better to have the ultimate principles? Why are middle principles better than ultimate principles? Well, what he means is better for me, because I can't give you the ultimate principles. It would be much better for me, given what I want to do, that I only have to give you middle principles. And so I'll give you these middle principles, and now the question is, okay, and how do you choose your middle principles? And his answer is great. I mean, he's walked right into the presuppositionalist parlor. Because he says, our middle principles have to accord with ordinary scientific rational practice. Well, there's a problem. And it's not the one that I started to tell you, but as an aside, how do you know what is rational if you don't have your ultimate principles of rationality? What he means here is, we must choose middle, not ultimate principles, and the middle principles must accord with what we usually call rational scientific practice. Well, it's always possible that what we call rational is not really rational. What we call scientific is not really well-grounded at all. But that's a throwaway argument. I'm going to give him that one. Because even granting that we all would agree on what is rational scientific practice, our claim, which he has never taken up or dismisses in one sentence, our claim is, I want you to do that. I want you to justify our ordinary rational principles and practices of science. And my claim is, you can't do it without the Christian worldview. Because my approach to science as a Christian is not to go and to reform the way science is practiced usually. Let's just talk, getting away from theoretical and laboratory debates, think about medical science, the way in which we usually choose medical treatments to solve problems. And that's a paradigm of what we consider rational scientific procedure, problem solving, so forth and so on. And what I would argue is what we all call rational scientific practice, you can't make sense of unless you have a Christian worldview. We have people who are acting as scientists, people who are acting as logicians, people who are making moral judgments out there all the time, and that's all I need to begin with as a presuppositionalist. Just give me people the way they are, and they can't make sense of the way they are. And so all I'm pointing out here is he wants to choose middle principles based on our common practices, and I'll say, fine, how do you justify our common practices? That's exactly where I want to go in the argument. But the sad thing is, having said that, there ain't no more. I told you there are a few more illustrations of this admission that he doesn't have general theory. Let's look at pages 54 and 55 real quickly. Right in the middle of the page. He says, Salmon's efforts at meeting the problems raised by the critics are only a beginning, since at the present time we do not have a sufficiently worked out theory of confirmation. Well, I'd say that's the atomic bomb admission. It's not sufficiently worked out, but I'm going to rest on it. Well, we have every right to ask, why did you choose to rest on it if it's not sufficiently worked out? Well, you know where I'm going with this. The only reason he could have is not an epistemic one. The reason is what? Personal. I like this theory because as I see it, this theory will help me get where I want to go. So theories are being used like convenient taxis. If this taxi is going the direction I want, I like it. If it's going where I don't want, I ignore it. And so he likes Salmon's theory, even though he admits it's not sufficiently worked out as a theory of confirmation. And then go down to the next paragraph. He says, yet it is not necessary to have a completely worked out theory of confirmation or induction to realize that typical alleged counterexamples to the verifiability theory of meaning only end up showing that an inadequate view of confirmation has been assumed. Really? It's not necessary to have a worked out theory to realize that the challenges to the theory don't really challenge the theory. They only challenge something else. On what basis or standard does someone realize this? That's what I wrote in my margin. Again, I'm not trying to be mean to Mike Martin. I'm willing to let him say all the things he wants to say. I just keep asking, like a little kid, why? Why did you say that? What do you mean by that? How does that work logically? How does someone realize that if you don't have the worked out theory? Indeed, he says, I know of no clearly agreed upon case. What a weasel sentence. I know of no. Okay, does I know of no translate it is true that? It's an autobiographical remark, exactly. The fact that he doesn't know of one doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I know of no, and then listen to this, clearly agreed upon case. Now, if he said agreed upon case, that'd be bad enough. Because we have to say, who's doing the agreeing and disagreeing here? But he qualifies it even more. He goes, no clearly agreed upon case. So that if we were to offer something and say it does look like, you know, there's general agreement on this, then he'd come back and say, but it's not clearly agreed upon because here are some counterexamples.
Or if you present the transcendental argument, he'll fall back and say, it's not clearly agreed upon because I don't agree with you.
Yeah, the whole thing is a long argument in a circle. That's what I'm trying to show you. If he doesn't have a general theory, and yet he makes comments like what is irrational, what's likely, what's probable, what's plausible, and so forth. If he doesn't have a general theory, every time he appeals to those, he's going back to something which is not worked out, and you have to ask, well, why are you approaching it this way rather than that? And the answer is, because this approach doesn't get me where I want to go. So, in light of certain controversial, unworked out theories in epistemology, which will get me where I want to go, it is very likely that no argument in the future will be developed. I can't even remember all the qualifications to put them in there for you. Isn't this terrible? And we haven't even thrown a rock yet. All we've done is saying, talk to us. Now, I'm trying to show you by this little discursive method what I mean when I say, if you'll learn to ask the right questions, unbelievers will always put the rope around their own neck. You know, you don't have to come on and toe-to-toe say, I've got better arguments than you, I've got evidence you haven't dealt with, and so forth. We do have better arguments, we do have evidence. But one very effective apologetical approach is just to have unbelievers explain what they're saying. So, you know, are you saying that you know that the future will be like the past? Oh, it's very likely. Are you saying that it's likely in view of a certain view of history? And on and on and on. You start asking these questions and whittle it down, and in every case, no one is ever going to come out and just reason in the circle so blatantly that they're going to say, God doesn't exist, and what's my premise? God doesn't exist. It's not going to be that easy. But if you pick and pick and pick, and remember, you'll probably not be liked for doing it. They killed Socrates for doing that sort of thing. But if you just keep asking questions and needling and pushing and qualifying and analyzing, what it always comes down to is, well, given my presupposition that God doesn't exist, there's no good argument that God exists. You say, wow, that's not very impressive, is it? Given your assumption. Now, before we get too high and mighty, I want to point out something else. Every argument that I can use to prove God's existence, the resurrection of Christ, and so forth, assumes what I'm trying to prove. Let me give you a counter. I'll play Michael Martin for a minute here. I say, well, you know, Michael, you should be a Christian. You should believe that God exists, Jehovah exists, because then you can make sense out of scientific induction. This is why I can make sense out of it. Well, because God keeps nature uniform. Well, how do you know he's going to keep nature uniform? Because he promised to do so. He's going to say, can you guarantee God will keep his promises? What am I going to say? No, but I believe him. I have faith that he does keep his promises. And so he's going to say, oh, I see. So that if you have faith that God will keep his promises, then add in all the stuff in the black box, you can come out at the other end and say, there's good rational reason to believe God exists. So if you have faith that God exists, there's good reason to believe God exists. Should I be embarrassed by that?
No.
Many evidentialists say I should, because I'm admitting to quote-unquote circular reasoning. I'm not embarrassed by that at all. All I want you to see is, what I've been doing to Michael Martin, he can do to us as well. However, there is a great difference, and this is where I think the apologetical argument ends. We say, fine, then choose your worldview. The worldview that I've, you know, put together as a coherent system, where I've assumed what I'm supposed to be proving, and then I've gone through all this and given you a general theory and so forth, that worldview supports what? Moral absolutes, science, logic, human dignity, and you can add to the list if you have other arguments, those are the ones I usually use. So that's right. And your worldview, which is also a faith commitment, to be sure, doesn't support reason, doesn't support science, doesn't support moral arguments or absolutes or human dignity, etc., etc. Now, should I be all that concerned that that's what it's whittled down to? One worldview that comports with our practices in science and logic and ethical living, and another one that doesn't comport with it? No, I'd say that's the end of the argument. That's all I want to say. And people will say at that point, they'll say, well, that doesn't force people to become a Christian. I said, no, it doesn't. Because some people prefer irrationality to submitting to God. Well, people don't always have to admit it. I said, that's right. People don't always admit what their problems are. But in terms of argumentation, you've got two worldviews, two coherent or allegedly coherent systems, but only mine makes sense of coherence. Mm-hmm. So here you have a coherent system which is incoherent.
It becomes faith versus faith.
Well, now, Christians will often say that. Let me explain, Howard. I'm saying more than it's just faith versus faith. It is that. In the end, he has a faith commitment, I have a faith commitment. But I'm saying my faith commitment supports rationality, your faith commitment destroys rationality.
Right.
Okay? And so if somebody admits that, I've had people ask this question and say, well, what if the unbeliever admits that and says he's not going to become a Christian? I say, well, he's all the more answerable to God, but he's not going to stop living like a Christian, I mean, to a certain extent, because even in admitting this, he has to use human language. And the use of human language assumes principles of meaningfulness, you know, rational discourse, and so forth. And so he has to assume the Christian worldview, even to say, I refuse to follow the Christian worldview. So let's push further. So the person says, okay, he can't say anything. I say, that's right. In the most literal sense, we've closed his mouth. He has no argument. He can't even begin to offer an argument or speak about not being able to offer an argument. Now, what I want to know is, if things come down to that point, why is that a defect in presuppositionalism? It seems to me that means we've won the day, right? Unless you mean presuppositionalism or any apologetical theory should be tested on the basis of compelling belief. But no theory can do that. No argument can do that. What I'm getting at is if people are perverse enough, even if you've reduced them to absurdity, they might prefer their absurdity to having to live for the glory of God. So please don't take what I'm giving you, which is pretty high-powered philosophical stuff, out of context. I realize that all of what I've said today is in terms of my worldview too. And all I want to get across to Michael Martin and to others is that your worldview doesn't support rationality. And if he says, oh, I can admit that and not become a Christian, then I can say, please step up to the mic and tell everybody that. That's all I can ask, is that you at least admit that to everybody, so that others will see that their choice is that if they want to be rational, they're going to have to be Christians as well. If they choose irrationality, all right. But apologetics never was intended to twist people's arms and make them believers. It's to leave them without an excuse. Okay, Richard.
No.
Oh, I thought you were raising your hand.
That contradiction. I'm sorry. Aren't you saying that... Is it true that there are non-Christian worldviews that support rationality, perhaps, but they don't support the full string of things you're talking about, logic, science, human dignity, freedom. In other words, can you find an alternate worldview that maybe will support one of those or something, but not the full...
Yes, I'd be willing for argument's sake to have somebody say, well, what I assume is logic. So now I've got a foundation for logic, because that's a transcendental for me.
Right, but I can't explain
that. I mean, I don't think they understand what a transcendental is when they say it, but I say, okay, fine, fine. But now if you've got logic, obviously you don't have freedom, do you? Because logic doesn't allow for variation. So if logic's your transcendental, none of us make any free choices. Now what they have to do is have another transcendental, and you know what's going to happen? They're going to give me a transcendental that conflicts with their logic transcendental. Now, I've got an integrating point, if I can use that metaphor, in God. I can, in God's personality, I can support not only human freedom and dignity, but also the universality of the laws of logic and the uniformity of nature. And if you're listening closely, those of you who are good philosophers, what I've just said to you is that in every case, the non-believing option will be forced to an impersonal view of the universe. It must always be impersonal. You see, that's the genius of Christianity, is that we have a personal approach to everything, to logic, science, you know, man's character, and so forth. And so we don't have to worry about conflicting transcendentals that are all integrated in the person of God. But if you impersonalize all those, then you're either going to get rational principles that rule out freedom, or you're going to have contingency freedoms that rule out universality. You'll just never be able to get them together. And what do we call this? The history of philosophy, the one and the many problem. Okay, so the personal God who is triune, as Van Til has pointed out over and over again, turns out to be the precondition of intelligibility for everybody's arguments. I kept you longer than I said, and you already gave me a half hour or more. Thank you for your patience. I did cut somebody else off, though, before we stop.
I just want to make a comment. The last thing you said was that if you want to be rational, you'll be Christian.
Yeah.
And in his book, The Case Against Christianity, he says if you want to be rational, you won't be a Christian.
Yeah.
Turn the table.
Yeah, we've turned the table on that, but it also shows what's at stake here. I mean, it's just the stark, I've got an approach to the world where rationality makes no sense apart from my following of Christ. And his understanding of rationality says I could never follow Christ. Just worldviews in conflict.